folks, and welcome back to NTI's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast was brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis, a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for the past two decades, 8 years of which he's been actively buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in the city on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So his company has a dedicated loan officer in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions. So you're probably already aware that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or if you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on emil.gorgis, that's emil.gorgis, emil.gorgis@tokyorealty.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, so for today's episode, back by popular demand, we've got Temple University adjunct professor, senior vice president at Genkai Capital, and fellow Israeli expat, Shai Greenberg, a resident commercial / institutional Japan real estate market expert. If you're a longtime listener of the podcast, you've probably heard him here in previous years. He's been quite generous with his time these past few years and this year as well. Came on for a long chat and to give us a thorough update on the market in the past year, as well as on trends and highlights for this current year, 2022. Always a fascinating conversation. I'm sure you'll enjoy it as much as I did. So without further ado, here's Shai Greenberg talking to yours truly about all things related to Japan's real estate property arena in 2021 and 2022. Enjoy, and I'll see you again on the other side. So Shai, welcome back. Good to have you on the show again.
Thank you very much. I'm glad you brought me back.
Yeah, I have to bring you back. Our annual chats, like, it's always one of my favorites. And according to download numbers, it's up there with our other resident expert, Dan Gallucci. He's our macroeconomics guy. And I think our chats have been becoming a lot more popular in the last couple of years, just because we're still in pretty much uncharted waters, right? Where it seems like it's ebbing and flowing, and you know, there's talk of opening the borders and then closing again, but we're still very much in it. This year is not really that different to last year, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the numbers of just corona patients, right, this current wave looks like it's declining, but it's been like, I don't know, five times larger than the last one. And it's so we're very much smack in the middle of it, not to mention everything that's happening in the geopolitical sphere. We are here recording it on March 4th. I don't know what day is it in the war with Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of uncertainties, a lot of things that are up in there, and nobody knows where the chips will fall. Mm. But last year, 2021 was, in some respects, very similar to 2020. In other respects, different. So transaction volumes in 2021 were high. Not as high as 2020, but higher than pre-corona levels. So there were a lot of transactions that took place, a lot of properties that changed hands. And that is something that's similar to 2020. And this is something that nobody expected, right? When we heard of this virus first. When you drill down to the details, you see there's some differences in who's buying those properties, because that's the beauty of the Japanese market. It's a very deep, robust, and diversified market in terms of the people who buy. So, you know, I'm also active in some, overseas markets. And it's not a given. And a lot of overseas markets are reliant heavily on foreign investors, etc. So if something like this happens, there's no kind of like, you know, other options. There's only one class of investors that buy properties. In Japan, it's not like, very much like the US and some other developed countries, but in Japan, it's very, very robust. So you saw a shift from, if 2020 was a year where the foreign buyers were really the stars of the game, they were punching, you know, more than their weight. Then in 2021, you saw they went back to their, you know, kind of like space, and the domestic buyers were buying more properties. But this shift happened. But overall, I think that the numbers were still very high. And still, feeding frenzy for every property that goes into the market. It's just being crazy. And, you know, I'm working for an independent asset manager, which means that we don't have a huge balance sheet. What we do is typically we put deals together via funds, etc. So we need to catch the property on one hand and go get the funding on the other hand and connect the two. And in this environment, it's very difficult because you have a lot of cash-rich buyers, foreign and others, domestic, that are just, you know, jumping in. So it's been challenging a little bit. I think it's been challenging for everyone. Everybody needs to kind of like, you know, be optimistic in their underwriting to be able to buy deals. That's the current market.
So you're saying the supply and demand dynamics haven't really changed that much from last year. People are just sitting on the sidelines waiting to pounce on anything that comes along, kind of thing.
Yes, exactly. You know, in Japan, a lot of the institutional properties are held by companies that, you know, have, you know, absolutely no pressure to sell. They don't have, you know, investors like a fund. So when you invest in a fund like us, then you have a finite life for the fund, like 5, 7 years, whatever, the 10 years, whatever, if 10 is too long, but whatever it is. And so at the end of the 5 years, you need to do something with those properties. So that's an opportunity for properties to change hands. Or if you have owners that are a little bit weak in their financials, and the properties are not performing well, then there'll be pressure from the bank to sell, right? Because the bank are, you know, starting to sweat. They want to get their loan proceeds back, the principal back. So they might push for this owner to sell. But if you are, a shosha, a trading company, whose, you know, credit rating is probably as good as the government of Japan, and their funding is probably zero or less, and there's any amount of funding, you know, available, why would you ever, you know, release a property from your holding? So a lot of those large class A iconical properties never change hands, or they change hands between group companies. So for instance, all the big developers in Japan have publicly traded REITs that they control. So what they do is, they sometimes sell floor by floor of a class A building to the REITs.
Right.
So the left hand is selling to right hand, and there's an appraisal in between that I don't envy, who needs to come up with a valuation that the market approves. So,
What's the benefit for them in doing that? Is it just moving funds around the cash books, kind of thing?
It's an exit. It's an exit. So they it's an exit for them, because basically this is a property that they developed from their own capital, and now they're selling it to a publicly traded REIT, which is obviously the public money. So they're getting a cash inflow, but they're never giving up control of the properties. They still benefit from asset management fees from the REIT and property management fees, because they're the property manager. And it's still part of their portfolio. It's just they got a chunk of money for it.
Okay, understood. And has these sort of dynamics also led to any change in appetite for different types of assets? Are they looking at less commercial, more residential, alternative data class, anything of that sort?
Yeah, I mean, the whole J-REIT sphere is very interesting. There's been a lot of like different dynamics. It used to be the market really valued specialized REITs. So you had residential REIT, office REIT, retail REIT. But in recent years, the value, the market more, values more economies of scale. So a lot of those REITs under the same manager merged to create one REIT that manages all property classes, etc. But the dynamics that we mentioned prior to this, with the market being really, really tight, that's what's pushing a lot of institutional investors into asset classes that are kind of like alternative asset classes. Historically, have not been asset classes that institutional investors invested in, and this is a trend. You know, in many cases, Japan is kind of like a couple of years late when you're looking at trends compared to the US. And so this is a trend that started in the US, I think, way before Lehman shock, but accelerated after the GFC. So you saw, for the first time after the GFC, an asset class that nobody would ever imagine can be an institutional asset class, single family homes, yeah. Right? Who would imagine single family home can be an institutional asset class? Became an institutional asset class through SFR, single family rentals, publicly traded REITs, a lot of funds investing in this now. It's a huge business and a very popular one. You also had the same thing with student housing, which I'm involved in the US. Student housing was something that institutional investors didn't want to have anything, you know, to do with. I mean,
yeah.
I imagine you've seen Animal House.
Yeah, to way too hands-on, right?
Bonga, you know. Yeah. So, you know, it sometimes it can get a bit crazy. So they say, oh, it's too much of a headache. So they stayed away from it. But now there's publicly traded REIT. There was a few, but two were privatized. And you have a lot of funds and some multifamily funds also investing in student housing. And you see the same trend with other types of properties as well. Not so much in Japan, but in the US, you see this with self-storage. There is one fund in Japan that invests in, one that I know of, that invests in self-storage. But it's very niche. It's very small yet still. You have this in the US. You have REITs that invest in jails, right? Privatized jails.
Yeah.
You don't have this in Japan. But you see in Japan, you see more institutional money going into assets like data centers.
Okay.
I did not know this, but apparently Japan is the second largest market for data centers, second only to Wyoming.
Okay. Globally.
I think there is a, like the sub, globally.
Yeah.
I think like the subterranean cable or something like that.
I was reading that we're quite popular for data centers in the Asia Pacific region, because compared to all of our neighbors, maybe Australia notwithstanding, but compared to most of our neighbors, the stability of the infrastructure, the power supply, obviously is attractive, right? If you compare it to where you might get it elsewhere. But I didn't realize that we're globally that big.
Yeah, that's what I heard. So there's more and more kind of like investments in player setting up funds coming into the market to do this type of investments. The other thing that institutional investors really, really stayed away from at all cost was cold storage.
Yeah.
So warehousing logistics is very popular in Japan. It's been so for this is another property class, by the way, that was imported to Japan. The first institutions that did this institutionally was Americans. And then it's now adopted, almost every real estate group in Japan is
one of the hottest sectors in Japan as well.
For sure.
Yeah.
But not cold storage. Because cold storage requires a lot of infrastructure. And in Japan, that infrastructure is the property of the owner, not the tenant. So okay. You need to maintain those refrigerators, the insulation, all that stuff that needs a lot of capex money.
So the landlord is actually responsible for this kind of equipment in the same way that I'm responsible for the aircon unit in a residential property.
Exactly. Okay. So that's not cheap. So it's a headache. So they stayed away from this. But now with, like you said, logistics being so hot, and this being kind of like a subsection of logistics, it's catching a bid. Okay. So all of this is starting, and also this is very new in Japan. Like I think 2021, we saw Kenedix, which is a very forward-thinking asset manager in Japan, the largest independent, though they had some merger last year, so I'm not sure if I can call them independent anymore. But anyway, very forward-looking and very kind of like innovative asset manager. Started a single family rental fund in Japan even. So you see all of this coming into Japan.
And how about the actual asset prices or the size of the assets? So you're saying the iconic assets that people might've been, you know, hanging out and looking for are not coming on the market. So are they, yes, are they compromising on cheaper assets? Are they dividing the capital between more assets? What are they doing there?
Yeah, exactly. So it's, if you are, you're realistic and you've given up on buying $1 billion office building in the smack in the middle of Tokyo, but you have $1 billion to spend, then you start buying smaller properties. So for instance, another very, very hot property globally is residential, right? Multifamily. But multifamily, we are struggling to buy those, because if we're doing a syndication or a fund for a single property, then they are too small. All the kind of like transaction costs and setting up an SPV, a special purpose vehicle, special purpose company, and managing it, and doing the distribution and trust bank and all that stuff, it doesn't really work for properties that are less than like 20 million US. Yeah. And a lot of the 20 million US is a very large residential property. Think about how much a single apartment goes for, multiplied by how many apartments, you kind of like you get the scale. So it's not really feasible, but you see large funds under one fund vehicle starting to buy properties as small as 10 million, 7 million, maybe even 5 million if there's a, you know, if there's a portfolio of three, you know, so which is something they wouldn't touch because it's a headache. It's a brain damage to close, to underwrite, to manage. It's much easier to manage one building in Marunouchi and be done with it, right?
Yeah. And the infrastructure for it, like you said, it's the same amount of work for a much smaller asset, right?
Exactly. And if you think about single family homes, that's even a bigger challenge because it's not even in a single, it's not like you have 20, 90 units in a single location where you send your maintenance guy once and you're done with it. It's maybe all over Kanto area or all over Tokyo. How do you do maintenance? How do you payments? How do you, you know, it's a challenge.
Okay.
You need technology for that.
So the shift to smaller ticket investments or assets.
Yeah.
Why the shift from commercial to residential? Why is there less interest in office buildings, say, and more interest in family homes?
I think there is a lot of interest in office, but there's no properties to be bought.
Okay.
Not enough transactions volume. So if you have that money that you need to spend, then it goes into multifamily. This is not reason number one. Reason number two is in the US, they call it sheds and beds. So the logistics and the multifamily are very, very popular, but logistics is hot and popular, and its existence in basically every country around the world now, logistics is in vogue. But multifamily is a really a US-centric thing. You don't have a lot of multifamily around the globe, and in Asia, you have no multifamily to speak of outside of Japan. So if you look at the press release of all the foreign funds that started buying multifamily in Japan, then they speak of the stability. They speak of the safety of the asset class. They speak of the stability of Japan, of the asset class, of the income stream, and it's all true. It's all true. It's all true. It's a very good asset class. But in actuality, what's happening is the investors want multifamily. And if you have an allocation to APAC, the only place you can buy multifamily. So the best multifamily market in APAC is Japan.
Yeah.
It's also the only one.
Okay. So
money flows.
So what have you seen with occupancies and vacancies and rental amounts? Again, if you're comparing residential to commercial, say, or last year to this year, what sort of trends are you seeing there? Is it also still more stable than commercial property in that aspect as well?
Yeah. No, I got it. I'll take it a little bit back, and I got to tell you, because we invest in Japan and we invest in the US. And I'm sure you're seeing this with your portfolios that you manage too. The Japan tenants, residential tenants, are the best in
absolutely
the world.
Absolutely.
I was across the table with one of the largest landlords in Japan that I think they have like 1 million units under management. And I asked them, what do they see with the people? They're performing well, but, maybe you got lucky, right? So I asked them, and they have a lot of smaller properties, like, 20, 30 units, but like a mountain of them, boatloads of them. And they told me, yeah, maybe one tenant in 10 years is behind the rent, right?
Yeah.
Which is with maybe 10% of the tenants didn't pay the rent. And you have to chase them. They pay eventually, but you still end the year with, like, let's say, depending on the property, 2, 3, even 4%
delinquencies.
Delinquencies, which is painful, right? You don't see this in Japan. They're very, very, very good, and also it's all streamlined, right? It's money going into your bank account, where in the US they bring a check to the leasing office.
Yeah,
I was like, hold on, what? I mean, it's just, why? It's 2022. I mean, get, like, set up some payments. It's a check. But check is in the mail,
But there's got to be some difference, pre-pandemic, post-pandemic, right? In both of these sectors.
Well, so this is interesting. This is interesting. As you know, real estate is cyclical. And we all thought that there'll be a lot of distress, etc., when the pandemic hit. And there is, but it's compartmentalized into certain asset classes like retail and certain types of hotels, hospitality.
Yeah.
But in office and residentials, this is not the case. I mean, the market is very robust and very good. However, right? If you drill down to the details, there is some reasons to be concerned, because what you're seeing is, while the sales for market, right, the investment market, as I described it, there's a feeding frenzy for every property that goes into the market, and the cap rates are compressing, the prices are going up, the yields are compressing, the prices are going up. On the rental, on the tenant side, you see some cracks in the shield, because if you look at Tokyo office, rents started to decline, since the beginning of 2020.
Mm.
So a slow decline, and vacancies are slowly increasing. And so it should be a reason for concern if you're buying, you know, it should be a reason to concern if you're buying office, but it's apparently not, because competition is so fierce for every property, you're getting the maximum bid for every property that goes into the market. Sorry, without, you know,
cat thinking issues here. Sorry. But part of this would be because I've seen transaction volumes have been skyrocketing outside of Tokyo, right? Like, so I saw Tokyo, Yokohama, Osaka are down. Nagoya is slightly up, but the satellite cities like Saitama, Chiba are up 30%, 60%, 70%. So part of it might be, I mean, I know that Japan is, it's still in Asia. So there's not, it's not like people are migrating, you know, by the boatload to the suburbs to work on the mountaintop, but still there is some awareness of the fact that, I mean, we have shifted partly to working from home wherever possible. So do you think part of that is maybe companies restructuring offices into smaller satellite headquarters and people looking for a bigger office space at home? So they're moving to maybe suburban or satellite cities and so forth. Is that maybe what's causing some of that?
With companies, when in the beginning of the pandemic, there were a couple of headlines like that, right? But I've not seen a huge like the diaspora of, you know, company living en masse from Tokyo. Regarding homes, I think this is the case. I think people wants to live slightly more comfortable in slightly larger apartments. Or even
home
houses.
All the time, right? Everyone's home all the time.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, more for sure. Like I'm working from home today, but excuse my attire, right? But there's a huge demand for single family homes. Huge. And a huge, if you look at all the single family, like the home builders, they had a bonanza year last year. I mean, look at all of them, their revenue went up. Double digits, 40, 60%. You know, there's a lot of demand for single family homes, but I think part of the reason why you see volumes decline in Tokyo, I'm not following Osaka that closely in other cities, but why you see volumes decline in Tokyo is simply because there's no properties.
Yeah.
So if I'm looking at my neighborhood, There's nothing. I mean, there's obviously there's few property single family homes on the market, but really, 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 like a trickle of what it was before the pandemic. Okay. I don't know why people are not, releasing their properties now. So maybe that's a reason. And prices have went up considerably. So if I want to live in a little bit more leisure, I want a single family home. Maybe I cannot afford to live in Setagaya-ku anymore. I need to go down that same, train line into Kanagawa,
yeah,
and buy something in Yokohama or vice versa in Chiba or Saitama. I think this is part of my estimation.
Okay.
My speculation.
But like you're saying, that, and we've seen that as well, there's not a huge amount of assets available on the market, even if you do want to, which kind of brings me to the other point is that we were talking last year about people, investors, institutional investors, but also private investors, not being super active in the market because they were hoping for, if not a wave, at least a substantial amount of distressed properties coming on the market. And I remember that we talked about it last year. We said, yeah, maybe towards the third quarter of 2021, we're going to see a little bit more of that. That still hasn't happened though, has it? I mean, there's no one's really taking action on reclaiming these mortgages or anything.
No, they really don't. They really don't. I mean, I'm not sure why. I have some theories, but I'm not sure why. It's in my view, it's maybe guidance from the government because they don't want to see markets crashing.
Unofficial policy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unofficial, but like, you know, what is it called? Window guidance or something like that. Or it is simply, they've seen what happened in the GFC and they assumed that the same thing is going to happen now. Assumed it did. So if they do a fire sale, or you know, on the bottom of the cycle, then they're going to have to do a lot of write downs. But if they just hold their breath a little bit longer, then they'll be selling in the top of the cycle, or getting paid back at the top of the, if it's in the case of lenders, getting paid back the entire principal at the top of the cycle. So they might as well hold on to it. And they have strong, the banks themselves have very strong balance sheets. You know, a lot of cash on hands. If anything, they have the opposite problem. They have too much cash on hands. They don't have a way to deploy it. So they don't have the pressure of, okay, you know, if I modify this loan, I need to, you know, keep more cash on reserve and I need to raise more capital. They don't have these issues. So there's no pressure on the lenders themselves. So they don't extract that pressure onto the borrowers. So the borrowers themselves are not going to say, oh, let's fire sell my property, right? Unless somebody's, you know, putting a gun to the hand and telling them to sell it now or else I foreclose.
And that's not happening. So the underlying assumption here is still hold your breath and ride it out. So this is actually still with this, I don't know how optimistic is the word, but is there a sentiment from lenders and from landlords? Is there a sentiment that we're heading towards the end of this and things are going to be better soon kind of thing?
No, but for a great extent, we're not in a, you know, if you look at the cycle, we're not in the bottom of any cycle.
No.
To a great extent, we, you know, maybe with, again, with hospitality and some retail, but for any other property class, maybe rents are declining a little bit. Maybe there's a little bit of more vacancy, but if you put it on the market, you're getting, you know, prices you couldn't dream of 3 years ago. So from the lender's perspective, it's okay because the value of their collateral is still high.
Yeah.
So it's okay.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, or if you just need summer quiet to hide away from the world. So they offer a variety of options for families, for corporate relocations, or simply if you're transitioning between homes in Tokyo. Now, the properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They've got fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens, and they're just a delight to stay in, a fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know they're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own, but long-term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profits or a holiday home that you want rented out when not in use via short-term stays, drop them a line today. See how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth your visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at emil.gorgies, G-O-R-G-E-E-S, at tokyorealty.jp. Yeah, we've seen from this on our end of the market as well. We've seen, we obviously deal in the cheaper end of the market, but we had maybe 3-4 months of softer prices at the start of last year, and then that just went back to normal. It was pretty much business as usual across the board. And same as you're saying, rents slightly on the decline, vacancies, we haven't seen really rise, but they do tend to be longer. But aside from that, yeah, not a huge change. So you're saying that not only are they not taking action on calling these loans, they're also pretty loose with their money still, right? They're still giving them out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, lending conditions are still very, very good. I mean, they're still, the banks are still keen on lending to real estate. Interest rates are still very, very low in Japan. Mm. There have been in the past, call it 1.5 months or 2 months, there have been a little bit creeping up of the interest rates. And that is mostly concerned when it comes to mortgages, to home loans. So some condo developers that I'm speaking to are a little bit concerned about that. Because, you know, if mortgage rates are going up, then obviously affordability might become an issue.
But like you said,
they're having very low level, but still very low.
They've had the best years they've had in a while, right? So they're not really going to be in pain.
But it's still very low. I mean, everything needs to be taken into perspective, right? So instead of, let me put it into perspective, because if you're in US, right, and you're hearing low and high, they're still paying like, I think, 4, give or take.
Yeah.
And or maybe, I don't know. So in Japan, before the rise, before the increase, you could have gotten a mortgage on a variable rate for home loan at what? 45 basis points?
Yeah.
0.45%.
Yeah.
So it went up. Oy vey. Yeah, it's 0.6.
Yeah.
Right? Just to put things into perspective.
And are they also loose with their funds for new projects, for something a bit more risky, like development?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. We're out there raising loans from banks, speaking to banks and to mezzanine lender and non-banks. Everybody is still keen on investing to the sector.
Okay.
Of course, you know, some hotels, some retail, maybe a little bit more of a difficult conversation, but for the kind of like plain vanilla office, plain vanilla residential, yeah, they're still accommodating.
Okay. And is there any preference now? I've been reading about this, but it might be more in other countries. Is there any preference to developers that are more modern compliance aware, like they're putting in systems, they're putting in lower emission buildings, anything of that sort? Is there any preference to lend more to those versus old school developers?
I heard some murmurs about like green bonds or like green lending.
Yeah,
but it's still very, very, very nascent, very, very small in Japan. But you're seeing more and more properties and companies getting kind of like ESG compliant and getting the building certified, etc. But you see this a lot in the public sector, publicly traded companies and publicly traded J-REITs.
Yeah.
And to be honest, that's because it's a requirement from the investors, the pension funds, the institution investors that buy those stocks. They require them to be ESG compliant.
Because they're shareholders.
So they
okay.
Yeah. With private properties, less so.
Okay. And you've mentioned hospitality a few times now. So you've mentioned, and I think I'm seeing the same thing, but I'd like to hear what you're defining this as. I am seeing a large difference in interest between various types of hospitality properties. There are definitely some that are suffering and feeling the pain and are maybe not distressed, but definitely selling it at very reasonable prices, but definitely not all of them, right?
No, the driving distance from city center resort hotels are performing very well throughout the pandemic. They've been performing very well. So Tokyo, everything in Karuizawa or I don't know, anything that is like a 2.5 hour drive from Tokyo is full. Anything that is a business hotel in city center is struggling.
Yeah. How about resorts? We've been looking at you know, like ski resorts, beach resorts, places that we thought were dependent on international tourism, but they're not, they don't seem to be struggling as much. I mean, they are, but not as much as I thought they would be.
I mean, look, 80% of the tourism in Japan is domestic anyway.
Exactly. Yeah.
We're not Thailand, right? In Thailand, it's probably the other way around. 80% is inbound and very, I don't know the exact numbers, but in Japan, I checked, it's 80% domestic. So, you know, you might have 20% decline, but there's some equalizing factor, because all of the Japanese tourists that used to go to ski abroad or, you know, Hawaii every year, now they have to go to Okinawa.
Yeah. Or to Niseko, right?
Or to Niseko. Let me pull back a little bit and ask you a question that I'm interested with. So I told you what I see on the institutional side from banks and lenders. What do you see on the private side? Are banks lending? Because after the Suruga shock, right, there was a period where they, you know, no. Salaryman loan, no. And then it kind of like, did it defreeze a little bit? Or?
Not a huge change. Not a huge change. So we've seen them being a little bit more picky on locations. Which for me was kind of counterintuitive, but like if pre-pandemic they were talking about central locations in all big cities, now they've suddenly pulled back and said, no, central Tokyo and central Osaka, like, you know, Fukuoka, which was, you know, they were lending happily for Fukuoka 3 years ago.
Yeah.
No, we're not doing that at the moment. We're waiting to see what's going to happen with COVID. For me, that was, I thought it would be the other way around, right? But they're a bit tighter on that. And they've started adopting some strange criteria that I'm guessing might be related to them wanting to ensure to be a bit more diversified. Like, for example, minimum, if they're lending for a small building, it's got to have a minimum of 6 doors. Or they'd say, well, you know, 4 to 8, but we really prefer if it would be 6 for some reason, right? And I guess that's got to do with diversity and hedging and you know, not relying on single income streams. But aside from that, no, like you mentioned, interest rates haven't changed much, willingness to lend hasn't.
So what do you see on interest rates? Is it, what is it, mid-2s?
For investment properties, for long-term residents, somewhere between 1.7 to 2 point something. Not really mid-2s. And for owner-occupiers, same as you mentioned, 0.6 at most, in most cases. Yeah. And still close to 100% for homeowners and 60, 70% LTV for investment properties. So not huge changes there. And the interest hasn't gone down at all. I mean, people, if anything, people contact us a lot more than they used to. Initially, because they think maybe the market is a lot softer there. So we have to disappoint them and tell them that, you know, not that much has changed here. But they're still very much, very much in the market. And you've mentioned when we've exchanged a few emails beforehand, you've mentioned something about Niseko being a unique case in some way, right?
Yeah, I mean, so this was a revelation for me. Because you know what I'm doing is basically if the equivalent for stock trading is value investing, right? We're value investors. You look at the cash flows and we try to mitigate all the risks and find something that you know throws a little bit of cash yield.
Yeah,
that's what we do. And when I came back to Japan from New York. In 2012, I was working for a consulting company. It was a consulting company that had a large appraisal department. And one of my friends, an appraiser, went to Niseko. I remember it clearly. He went to Niseko and he came back and he said, Shai, it's insane.
Yeah.
This small little circle around the ski slopes is yielding 10 times the price per square meter or per tsubo, whatever, is 10 times more than just, you know, a block away. It's insane. Yeah. It's a bubble. So, you know, I filed it under bubble. And I and I'm not an avid skier, you know. There's not much snow in Israel.
Yeah.
So I never went to Niseko. And then I took, I started managing a property in Niseko last year. And I went for the first time. I'm like, first of all, have you been?
No, never. But I keep seeing pictures from friends and family going there.
It's not Japan.
Yeah.
It's not Japan. The villas, you know, the architecture, the grandiose. It's not Japan. And all the stories, and I met all the, you know, all the brokers, right? The stories about these Asian buyers that come in and swipe their card and buy an $8 million
and Australians, yeah,
home that they spent 2 weeks a year in. It's incredible. So I went back and I looked at the government prices for land. There's a survey, it's called Rosenka.
Mm.
And they don't have it for a lot of locations in Niseko, but they have it for the main street and some adjacent streets. And especially, and you can see historical going back to 5 years. So I checked historical going back to 5 years. Again, that guy told me it's a bubble in 2012, right?
Yeah.
I looked at historical for 5 years, the price and the government price, right? The actual price is much higher.
Official valuation, yeah.
The official valuation of the government. The price went up by 2,000. I don't remember the exact number, but 2,540% or something like that. Bitcoin. Okay. And I've never seen, I have never encountered the real estate property that does that. So I was like, wow, there is another form of investment in real estate that I wasn't, wasn't on my side, which is basically momentum. So not value investment, but momentum investment, because that's what happened. You know, as more and more investors came into the market, prices started to go up. It's incredible. And I don't know if it's a bubble or not. There is no leverage involved because no banks are lending there.
Mm.
So everybody who are buying properties in Niseko are buying it cash.
Yeah, it's definitely lifestyles of the rich and famous up there. I don't think there's any, and there's no yields to speak of. Although it's one of the only places where you can actually Airbnb and do Minpaku and stuff. There's still not huge yields, I suppose, right?
I wouldn't think so because it's very seasonal.
Mm.
They're trying to have some summer activities. I mean, it's beautiful and it's dry and it's cool in the summer. So there is some inbound in the summer. A lot of, retirees going there to play golf and enjoy the tasty food, but it's mostly in the winter. Yeah. But it's incredible. It's beautiful. There seem to be solid market for the properties that is not slowing down, and is not nothing much has traded obviously over the last since the corona started.
Mm.
But because nobody is leveraged, nobody has a lot of, again, pressure to sell. So prices have not declined. It's just stagnant.
Yeah.
And everybody there, have made so much money on past seasons that they just enjoy the vacation and playing golf all day.
I think they could use a bit of stagnation up there. It has been going, I don't know, like you say, I don't think that bubble is the right way to define that market because there's no distress there, but it was definitely a bit too hot for comfort.
Yeah. I mean, if if we're on that subject, some investment ideas or kind of like interesting avenues that maybe people are not have their antenna up is Niseko itself. I don't know if it's going to continue or not, but searching for the next Niseko is a national sport in Japan.
Yeah.
So Hakuba or some other locations have been gaining, and also around Hokkaido too.
Yeah.
There's a feeding frenzy and price going vertical on other areas in Hokkaido as well. Because there's like, ooh, everybody going there now. Whoop,
Yeah, we've got people looking at Otaru near Sapporo, which is quite popular. And around Nagano, Yokokogen and Nozawa Onsen and those kinds of places,
They're not quite up there yet, but they're definitely, like from the English-speaking perspective, we always measure it by Australians because they're close and they love to ski and they love to... Once you see more and more and more little guest houses run by Australians and New Zealanders, you know that it might be inching in that direction. We'll see how that goes, but it's definitely not up that level yet.
Nozawa Onsen is also a ski resort?
It's not a ski resort, but it's not far from.
Okay.
It's not far from them. I think it's not a ski resort. I'm not a, like you, I don't know much about winter sports, but I know that it's popular. Okay, so we've done a...
that might be of interest for the listeners. Other type of asset classes that I think are of high potential in Japan and are not getting a lot of love is senior housing.
Exactly what I was going to ask you about.
So, okay, sorry. So go ahead.
No, that's it. Please.
So I was looking at a couple of senior housing portfolios in the last year, and they're very challenging. They're very complicated because there's all these different classes or different licenses that are entitled to different type of assistance from the government, etc. So they're not simple. But they're very difficult for institutional investors to buy, which is good because they don't have competition, right? They are not loved by Japanese investors, domestic investors.
Why is that?
Because this is a place where the explanation that I got, because I was like, exactly why? The explanation that I got is because this is a place where people unfortunately eventually die, right? It's not, you know, your tenants are not toddlers. Your tenants are in their 90s.
Yeah.
So, you know how Japanese have a very adverse relationship with death. And so, for instance, an apartment that somebody died in is a jikobuken and reduces in value and you have to disclose it, et cetera, et cetera. This is a property that people always die in.
Yeah.
Okay. So they don't, my understanding is they don't like it because of that. But from the perspective of somebody who don't mind, you're getting higher yields than residential. You're getting slightly higher yields, okay? And don't expect like, you're getting a property that is master leased to an operator, which is in many cases a very strong, strong balance sheet, strong, credit tenants. It takes this property from off of your hands for sometimes 10, 15, 20 years lease. And it's like triple net leases in the US. You really have to worry about almost any and nothing except for, you know, paying the tax. So it's not like triple net, sorry, but you know, just the envelope of the building, everything else. It depends on the contract. Again, you have to, but in many cases, everything else, the interior, the HVAC, et cetera, and the operation is on the tenant. So your tenants are not the elderly people. Your tenants are,
the operators. Yeah.
A high credit operator.
So how would
It's very hands off.
How would you, because I know that in this sector, if we're looking, for example, if we're comparing it to hospitality, like you said, the smaller business hotels, love hotels, not doing that well, maybe not exactly. And if you want to get into the hotels that are performing well, that's a very big ticket item, right? But with senior living, there are smaller operations that a private investor could conceivably definitely buy into. But then how would somebody like me approach this market? Do you first contact the operator and ask them where they want you to buy a property? Do you first get the property and then contact the operators? Do you build relationships to get in there? How do you actually go about it?
So that's another thing why I'm recommending it, because I wouldn't I can't recommend go buy a logistics property because there are hundreds of million dollars. Mm. But a lot of the senior housing facilities are small.
Yeah.
They're like a few millions, 5 million. 6 million, obviously you can get financing for those. So the requirements for capital are not that huge. And the portfolios that we've seen came directly from the developers. So the developer developed it. They already have an operator that will take this on when it's completed. So they either sell it while it's under construction with the lease in place, or they sell it after it's stabilized with the operator in place. You don't have to look for an operator. You just need to find the property. And it comes with the operator. And hopefully, if it's stabilized, it already has the tenants. You can also underwrite the cash flows that the operator gets, because it's all good and well that the operator is your tenant. But if they're not making money, then, I wouldn't sleep well at night.
Yeah.
So
you buy them directly. You buy them directly from the developers with a lease either in place or ready to be put into place.
Exactly.
Okay, that's very interesting. That's something that I think a lot of people will want to.
I agree. And the last one, because of the shortage of, salaryman loans, I wanted to buy my own property.
Okay.
But the interest rate was a little bit high. So I said, fine, what I'm going to do is, which is another idea, especially for permanent residents of Japan, what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a property where half of it is for rentals and half of it is my home.
Yep.
So obviously not a big property, not a lot of rentals, but still, this type of property qualifies for mortgage, for home loan.
As long as you're using half of it.
Yes. So I'm getting some commercial property while borrowing money at those, sub 1% rates. So, and that was especially the case when I went on this journey probably 2.5 years ago. But it sounds good on paper, but it's extremely complicated finding the land that is the right fit for this type of layout and dealing with this. We're doing some development, right? But we're dealing with the super general contractors of Japan, which are fantastic. But dealing with the contractors that build single family homes in Japan, boy.
Picnic.
Okay. It's a different, I've never seen a market like that in Japan. It's so peak. You have absolutely no way to know how much money they're making. You have absolutely, the knowledge gap is huge. They're very bad at estimating. I fired one and I'm fighting to get some of the money I paid him back because the initial estimate and the final estimate that he gave me was, I was like, what, for this price I'm selling the land, right? It's completely different. And also the design that he made was not compliant with a total disaster. So it's a good idea if you have the patience and the wherewithal to do it. It's another idea. But by the way, it's, according to my estimate, it's $100 billion market in Japan, the single family homes, home builders market, Chumon Jutaku, what it's called in order homes.
Yeah.
And I've never seen a market with so much fat and so much opaqueness. So I think it's really, really, ripe for disruption.
Yep.
And I know a lot of your viewers and listeners are tech people. If anyone wants to go on an adventure with me, and go bring some equality into that market and disrupt it a little bit.
Yeah,
I'm sure there is. If we capture just a few percentage of that $100 billion a year market, it's a sizable business. So if anyone wants, let me know.
So what you're talking about? General per order construction.
I'm talking about this. This is something that can be, not easily addressable with some prop tech solution. I think with some prop tech solution, you can bring you can decrease that knowledge gap and give some more power in the hands of the consumer rather than all the power being in the hands of the home builders.
Yep. Yeah.
And I think a lot of the industry participants will also appreciate it. I don't think all of them, want to keep the status quo. A lot of them are struggling with estimates as well. Like the contract that gave me the estimate, I don't think he wanted to trick me. I think he just didn't know how to do it.
No, they don't. They maybe just don't have the technological skills to properly assess it, right?
And the same issue happened with two other friends of mine from my company, actually, that are building homes at the same time. All the estimates were completely wrong from the architect. So this can be, put this product available to the public. We can put this product available to architects, to contractors. I have some ideas formulated.
And you can set up an actual construction company that actually provides accurate estimates, right?
that'd be a new. But yeah, that's anywhere, any other business in Japan, right? It's like crowded and competition is fierce.
Yeah.
And everybody are squeezed, you know, the margin are squeezed down. This is the only market where they're sitting pretty, right? I mean, like, yeah. Nobody has any idea, like, what's the cost and what's the margins and
yeah, and like you said, they've had their best
can
year.
Charge whatever you want. Yeah.
Okay.
So if anyone wants, please give me a call.
So we'll definitely float that up to them. So what I'm hearing from you, especially in this last segment, as we're kind of starting to wrap up, and what I'm also hearing from what you're talking about, what you're saying about lenders and developers, is general sentiment is positive heading into 2022, right?
To a great extent, yes. Some have some concerns. To a great extent, it's like, yeah, you know, the fundamentals are still solid. There's a great demand for properties. And everything that I described is marginal still, you know, rate of change type of things, not something that, you know, will put a dent on the volumes of investments pouring into Japan. If anything, more and more institutional foreign investors are setting up shops in Japan and are getting into the market.
How about you guys at Genkai? What have you been capitalizing on, like, all along these last couple of years?
So for us, it's a little bit more challenging to deal with this, like, plain vanilla property types where all the big institutions with the big balance sheet and the big checks are coming in, because again, we need to. So we are also delving into a little bit more development, a little bit of more the alternative asset classes, like cold storage, etc. We are doing a little bit more outbound.
Okay.
We're gearing up to open our second India fund, hopefully the first half of this year. So we're hard at work at it. And yeah, trying to find some interesting risk-adjusted return products to our investors.
And how did you go with there was a Fukuoka office being opened last year, no?
Yes, it's doing great. Actually, leasing is very, very strong and it's good. Have you seen the property?
No.
It's kind of cool looking black facade.
Yeah. So
Fukuoka
has been a good market throughout these last couple of years, right?
It's a great market.
Yeah.
Fukuoka is a great market and loved by many.
Mm. All right. Look, that's fantastic. Thanks again for your time. Super insightful as ever. And I think this time, like last year, I was kind of like worried to actually say out loud that I'm looking forward to seeing what the next year will bring. But I think I am kind of looking forward to 2022. It looks like things are definitely the vibe is good. I don't know if it's like the new normal or the updated normal or the end of a cycle. I don't know. But I'm feeling better than I have been in last year. So see where we
find it. Japan is a great market. Japan is a great market and real estate is a great asset class. Real property, you know, there's inflation, you're hedged. If your cash flows are independent of the financial markets, it's people living it or working it or shopping it, it's a real need that we provide. I think we're going to be fine.
Yeah, and here too, there's none of those mass layoffs and mass foreclosure waves and that stuff that's happening elsewhere.
Japan. Yeah. Steady as she goes.
Awesome. Well, great talking to you, man. Thanks for talking to you again and talking to us
Thank
again.
You.
We'll see you next year.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
All right. So huge thank you again to Shai Greenberg, Senior VP at Genkai Capital, adjunct professor, creator and head of the Real Estate Investment Program at Temple University, Tokyo. Fantastic and insightful conversation as always. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa, and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company, and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com. And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time. And until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.